That's how this station survives. Support the station. Celebrate the station. Have a very, very happy birthday, KGNU. There's nothing out there like you.
This program is supported by you, the KGNU listener member, and by Janelle Tucker of Tucker Group Real Estate. Janelle Tucker is committed to helping clients achieve their real estate goals, whether they are buying, selling, or investing. Janelle Tucker is equally committed to giving back to her community, which is why she partners with KGNU. More information and client reviews can be found at tuckergroupinc.com. That's tuckergroupinc.com.
This program is presented by you, the KGNU listener member, and by Z-Trip, providing 24/7 transportation for everyone in our community, including non-emergency medical transportation for both mobility and ambulatory passengers across Boulder and Weld counties. Z-Trip is also looking for drivers. More information at ztrip.com.
And you're listening to KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. Stay tuned next for It's the Economy. And good evening. You are listening to It's the Economy on KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. It's about a minute after 6 p.m., and I am your host, Liz Lane, this evening. I am thrilled to welcome in studio, live this evening for the hour, Chad Gordon. He's the founder and CEO of Green Star Advisors, a registered investment advisor. He advises individuals, couples, and families using holistic financial planning. His new book, Wealth by Virtue, has received numerous awards, including the 2018 Axiom Business Book Award, first place from Feathered Quill Book Awards for the Best Information Book of 2018, the New Apple Book Award 2018 Business Book of the Year, and Wealth by Virtue is a finalist for the Cal Writing Award, announced later this month, and the Indies Book of the Year Award, which will be announced in early June. Welcome to KGNU, Chad Gordon. So nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Liz.
So talk to me about your book. The title of it is Wealth by Virtue. So I'd like to start there because I think that lines up with your overall philosophy, and we can kind of dive into the finance specifics once we lay the foundation work.
Sure. So the title Wealth by Virtue has a couple different meanings, but to give it a little background, basically after a life of or a career of advising couples and families, I found that a lot of couples, there was no line in the sand for when they felt peace in their wealth or where they felt where it changed their lives. A lot of the times they would just accumulate money, and it really started with a thought with a client where I had a couple where they were literally trailer park millionaires, and they had accumulated all this money and they were living fairly frugally. And we met with them about optimizing different things in their finances, and I'd press them what would change in their life. And the truth was nothing would change if they made more money, if they had twice as much or three times as much, or even if they lost it all, their life wouldn't change. And my belief is that as you grow in wealth, you must grow in wisdom, and you must use it to focus your energy on the things that matter in life, like family and friends. So the virtue aspect of it has to do with a couple different things. The biggest thing would be maintaining a perspective on life and maintaining the reality of the fortunate life that we have and the importance of family and friends. Then the second thing is a more pragmatic thing, is that I believe that when you're patient and when you apply some of the traditional I guess you could say religious values of steadfastness and patience and frugality, that wealth becomes as inevitable as it can be.
So how do you get people, there's so many neat concepts. I mean neat, not cool neat, but sort of handy, tidy concepts that seem to be foundational and sort of wind their way through all of your philosophy. And one of them is time, is starting things super early at one's first job to take advantage of that opportunity to contribute however small you might be able to at that beginning leg of your career to the 401k or the retirement account. And you know, you can amplify that idea of time a little bit, and I want you to for our listeners, but the illustration that you provided in there of the two twins was really very, very illustrative. And in a way, it ties in with what you were saying about having a plan that you can execute and that is comfortable and has, you know, reality woven into it, that if you can start saving money early, the way your life might change is that you can stop saving money earlier than you might have otherwise.
Right, absolutely. And I'll try to rehash, without going into the numbers of it, I'll try to rehash the concept of it. And it's interesting because it seems like the older you get in life, the more you really appreciate the value of time to propel wealth. And so having this conversation with someone who's 21 years old versus someone who's 61 years old are two different concepts. But what I show in the book is I illustrate two twins that I call Terry and Mary. And they're the same age, same birth date. And Mary is early Mary. She starts saving at their 21st birthday. And she starts saving $100 a month. And then Terry doesn't start saving until their 30th birthday. But Mary stops saving on the same day that Terry starts saving.
At 30.
So they're both obviously identical in terms of time. But what's crazy is you see the two balances, and as they keep going, even though Mary has stopped cold saving, she has more money than Terry does on their 100th birthday.
So he never catches up.
So it's crazy.
Even though he doesn't stop contributing
for
30 years.
And so Terry's saving 70 years, yeah. And Mary's saving 9 years and still has more money because it's an early 9 is more valuable than a late 70. And, of course, those of us who are not 21 years old,
Fear not.
But it's still the same concept now. It's like the old Chinese proverb of the best day to plant a tree is 20 years ago, but the second best day is today.
Yeah, that's a good one too. So yeah, not too many people. Well, let's start even before that. Financial literacy is not something that is generally provided to people in any kind of in any of our basic education areas, and talk about that as an irony in a country that is driven by capitalism and by money and investing and what you can do with that. How crazy is that we don't teach people fundamentals?
It is crazy. I don't know. I don't have much to add other than to agree. It is insane. I don't know. It's in our society, it's really in bits and pieces. There's some community groups, some church groups, but there is not a systemized way of educating people on money. And that was really among the reasons why I wrote my book. Is I when you look at it, it's somewhat intimidating looking at it. It's the size of a textbook, but I really wrote it as something where anyone who's truly interested in learning this stuff and understanding it, it doesn't condescend to the reader, but it doesn't, I don't think, it's not above most people's heads if they read it in an organic way, but it's essential. People must learn this stuff. And unfortunately they start learning it in times of crisis when a spouse passes away or when they, you know, sometimes they'll inherit money or sometimes the market goes down a lot. And that's when they start getting interested in things. And people will tend to work 10 times harder to get out of a bad place than they will to actively put themselves in a good place.
Let's talk about that a little bit, about just the devotion of one's time and attention to this extremely important area of our life. As you very astutely point out, I think this is another really great notion that I will think about in the future. Money is a lot like oxygen. You have to have it to exist, but after you have what you need, no more oxygen is going to be of particular benefit to you.
Right.
So we have to understand this. Money, there's a certain essential quality to money for shelter, for food, just for the most basic things. And yet the concepts, as you say, are accessible to everybody, But the lack of time that is spent either in early education talking about this, and then maybe it's the idea that if you didn't learn this, and I run into women more often than men with this, that if you didn't sort of learn the basic rules about, you know, interest rates or debt or the time value of money or things like that, you kind of feel like you've missed the bus in your life. So
right.
And you haven't. So talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Right. Well, so first of all, it's never too late. And people... they should not be intimidated by this for two reasons. Number one, it's complicated, but it's not impossible to understand. But the other thing is that your livelihood literally depends on it. So two very good reasons. But really what, when I was writing it, I have three clients that I had in my mind. So to me, when you're writing, it's really important to imagine a human on the other end of your typing or writing. And I have three clients who are all widowed in their 60s. And as I was typing and writing, I was thinking, how would I explain this to this person or to this person? And all these things are completely understandable. And I think that what a lot of people have is when they understand finance through their life, it's always in the parts as they're doing them. So when they buy a house, they understand mortgages, they understand things like escrow and insurance and property tax. And then you learn that and you know that piece of it, but then that's sort of kind of the last you really think about it. Or maybe someone close to you passes away and you get an estate plan. And so you learn about trusts and wills and those things. And then years go on and that's kind of the last you think of it. But my objective was really to tie it all together as one comprehensive whole and to make it in so one cohesive arc of thought.
And you divided it into six different units or six right. different topics. And why don't we name those?
Sure.
And, I'll remind listeners.
I know these very well.
So
this is something I came up with a couple of years ago in my financial planning where what I was seeking to do was categorize the areas of finance. So I call them the six areas of finance. And in this order, they are banking, investments, real estate, insurance, legal planning, and tax planning. And so everything in your financial life is going to fit into one of those areas. And I put it in that order because they all lead into one another. So banking, I tee off the book with the seemingly simple thought that money is to buy stuff. Which sounds obvious. I mean, of course it is. But when you hold on to that thought, everything tends to line up in place when you look down the line of your financial planning. So if you look at all the assets in your pocket and when they all line up, eventually all that will buy stuff at some point in time. Or if you pass away with an estate, your kids may inherit it and then they'll buy stuff with it. But if you can quantify that time between now and then, two very important things come up is number one, inflation will eat away the purchasing power of those assets. And number two, the price of stuff always goes up over time. So when things will be purchased down the road, they will always cost more than what they do today. And as you do that, you start to say, well, okay, so money in banks, it doesn't make money over the long term. Basically, inflation and taxes wipe away any forward motion that you're ever going to have in a bank. Even in times, those who may remember the early 80s and 70s, when banks had 10% interest rates, obviously
that was nice.
Those days are long gone. And it was nice, but inflation, of course, was also the same rate. And taxes were roughly what they are today for the average person. So over, and I show this in the book, as I lay out from 1965 to present, if someone had $100,000, it really hasn't grown in real money over 50 years, even though the number has gone up. And so that leads into investments, and into real estate. And the whole idea of those two areas is basically having faith in the probability of what should happen. So investments, in all probability, the market goes up. When you buy a house, in all probability, the value of it goes up. Naturally, there are exceptions, and certainly it's looking at a long-term perspective. But basically, what you're doing is you're putting yourself on the other side of rising prices. Is instead of inflation being a headwind pushing you back, it's now a tailwind propelling your wealth forward. And so really you're basing on what should happen. So the other two, this next two areas of finance, insurance and legal planning, are really about protecting you from what could happen. You could pass away too soon and your family not have enough money, so you get life insurance. Your house could catch on fire, so you get, property insurance. Same with legal planning. Well, you could get, you could get sued, or you could, you're trying to protect your estate, or the different things that you do to protect yourself from what could happen. It's about the possibilities. And so anything is, so it's distinguishing what's probable and what's possible. And I think especially within my area as a financial advisor, with the market, people always get hung up with what's possible, and they get hung up with, well, this could happen, versus what's probable. And what the reality is, the market has overcome things far scarier than whatever the apocalypse du jour.
And isn't the, and granted, the last few months have been extremely volatile.
Oh, have they?
And one is heard anecdotes from, you know, investors, people on the floor, people that have done this for a living, saying really that while the run that has happened since the market tanked after the financial crisis in 2008, we're looking at, you know, 10 years of a run up has been great, and there's been some big rises, but the whipsaw, all that great feeling that people were feeling, it evaporates in just a couple of days. Isn't that a fascinating thing?
Absolutely. And it's interesting because I've been through multiple downturns over the 16 years or so that I've been doing this. And it's always interesting to see how quickly people's emotions will turn on a dime, both optimistically and pessimistically. Is if you were to talk to people in January, I mean, roughly as February 1st and things started getting crazy, people were euphoric, and and people will always justify what they want to believe.
And I want to remind listeners that you are listening to It's the Economy on KGNU Community Radio, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm your host, Liz Lane, tonight, and my guest in studio for the hour is Chad Gordon. He's written a really useful and interesting book called Wealth by Virtue. It covers just about every angle of personal finance. Any questions you might have, you can pick up the phone and call 303-442-4242, and Chad will answer those questions. As of February, things started getting crazy and people will believe what they want to believe. I was really stunned. And Alan Greenspan coined this phrase a while ago, before the bubble burst in 2007, talking about irrational exuberance. One of the things that really struck me in this latest run-up was how even international events that historically would cause a lot of investors to go for the door, like the possibility of a nuclear
exchange. That's a doozy.
With North Korea, right, on the Korean Peninsula. When Kim Jong-un was testing ballistic missiles in October of last year, I kept waiting for, you know, the big reverse, and it didn't happen, And, you know, some of Mueller's better days, at least from his investigation, have triggered some you know, big drops of, you know, fear maybe that we might have a constitutional crisis. But do you see in this market run and maybe some of the political competing political positions something uniquely stubborn in refusing to believe the downside is possible?
Sure. Well, so let me answer in principle and then in specific. So in principle, if you go to any financial website, whether it's Bloomberg or Yahoo Finance, and look at what direction the market is, and there will always be a headline that justifies it. So to me, a point of comedy is to go on days when it's positive and then it's negative, and they don't go on there to change the headline quickly enough. And so the market will be down and say, well, market rallies on this news, but they haven't updated it. On principle, what you have to always remember is that the stock market is a giant voting machine, and it's impossible to quantify why did those millions of people vote up or down with their buying or selling. And in mass, yes, society can feel certain things, and certainly when things are in a panic, it's everybody voting the market downward, and you can say this is probably what's going on. But with day-to-day swings, it's not. I mean, it's guessing at what it is. So in principle, who on earth knows? Nobody knows. As far as specific, I think that when you an interesting statistic is that since the financial crisis, there's been a lot of money on the sidelines. And not to go into politics too much, but just speaking objectively, half the country is not going to like the person running the show. And so if 2010, things are recovering from the financial crisis and Obama's in office, you know that half the country has assets and they don't believe it. They believe
they don't have confidence in this leader or
sure.
this trend.
Or like
or they don't want to participate. So
right. So if we put our heads back to 2010, everyone's talking about the double dip recession, which of course you and I know didn't happen, unless you want to count the next recession, which all recessions are eventually double dip. But eventually, 2010, half the country said, oh, well, the Affordable Care Act is going to tank the economy or whatever, again, the apocalypse du jour is at the time. And so today it's the same thing. It's not all that different. Is you can say, well, now things have obviously radically turned and you have half the country who doesn't agree with the person running the show. And without even judging who's right on in each time frame, everyone's always going to justify their own opinions and say, well, I think it's going to go down because of X, Y, and Z.
And from your perspective, and then I want to get to Steve, yeah. who's waiting online, but then from your perspective, that's irrelevant, that you need to be in the equity market because you have justifiable long-term faith
right.
that markets tend to
sure.
perform.
And before we pick
positively.
Up with Steve, I'll add to that is that I have a list in there going back to 1928 of what I felt was the scariest thing that year. And the reason that I could come up with why you should invest that year. So whether it's the Cuban Missile Crisis or something in the Great Depression, what I thought was the best thing. And then I add another column of someone investing a dollar starting that year and how the market just has a long-term callousness to our daily worries.
Interesting. Well, Steve is waiting to talk to us. Hi, good evening. You're on the air.
Hello, I'm calling from Denver.
Hi, Steve.
I'm looking forward to reading this book, which I have. And I have a question about investing in real estate, or maybe you have a better idea for me. My wife and I only have about $30,000 to invest. We both are starting late because of situations that we couldn't control. So we don't have much for savings right now, but we can invest $30,000. What would you do with it? Well, now, we have a place in Iowa that we can turn into a rental, and we have another little house there that we can turn into a rental if we buy it and fix it up. So this is what we're facing. Is what's the best thing to do with our $30,000?
Sure. Well, I mean, it is tricky to just answer a specific question. So let me answer it. Let me kind of twist your question a little bit, Steve. So I think if you're investing in real estate, what you have to keep in mind is the principle of leverage. So if you have $30,000, my assumption is that you're not looking at buying a house that costs $30,000. You're probably looking at a house that costs, if it's in Iowa, I'm going to say optimistically $200,000, where you'll put 20% down.
No,
and
no, it's a $20,000 house that we're going to, that it could be rented now. We're going to fix it up a little and make it higher rental.
Okay. Well, that's different. I didn't expect you to say that. So $20,000, that's a bargain. Sure. Well, here's how, if that's the route you're going to go, what I look for is one thing is that if it's $20,000, I'm going to assume that it's probably a fairly illiquid house because
yeah.
a house that sells for that little is going to be hard
so
to,
good.
Or for that low of a price. I missed what you said there, Steve. Say it again.
Yeah, it's a fixer-upper.
It's a fixer-upper. So, a couple things. Is it in a pretty remote market?
No, well, a small town, so things move slow, but the recovery is finally hitting southeastern Iowa, and things are moving now. Someone's about to build two apartment buildings in this little town, and so things are moving.
Right. So I guess the only thing I would encourage you to keep in mind is that when you purchase something in a small market like that, sometimes you can have real estate that's illiquid where you list it for sale and it's on the market for 3 years at a time or something like that. So as long as you and your wife are prepared for that possibility, then I would say as a second thought, calculate what's the cash flow on it. Is it rent? If it's $500 a month, well, that's $6,000 a year divided by a $20,000 house. Well, that's a really great cash flow for the amount of money you're putting in there. But then again, look at the other side. Is it's a small town, so how hard is it to find a renter? Obviously, looking at what's the cost to fix up. So it's a lot of moving parts. Like I said, it's hard to kind of throw off a specific question
right.
like that.
Would you have Steve and his wife consider Well, first of all, you probably ask them to make sure they don't have any debt that's
right.
accruing interest.
We don't have any debt right now. Okay. We took care of that.
Yeah.
And that's great.
So we're about to pull the trigger on this real estate thing, but I'm wondering if the market is better.
So here's the thing. So with the market, it's hard to say apples for apples, which is better, real estate or the stock market. Real estate tends to work well under a leverage situation. Real estate on average does like 4% a year would be normal. I know Denver, Boulder, that's not what's happened lately, but that would be a national average. In Iowa, my guess it would be closer to that number, to the 4% number. Small towns tend to appreciate a little slower. The market, just generally, if you're just going to the market for the first time after it's gone up for 10 years, I would just be cautious that you really educate yourself on the inevitability of volatility. So what tends to happen is when the market zooms up a lot, people get a little more interested in it than they typically do. And this isn't a dig on you, Steve, so don't take this term personally, but sometimes people call it the ignorant money because people who've never invested before suddenly invest.
Right.
And then they get scared when it's volatile for the first time in their lives and they pull out and never go back in again. So I would, just knowing nothing about your situation, I would start saving on a monthly basis into the market and really take a cold, honest look at the number in or the numbers in Iowa and the probability of getting stuck with a property that's hard to get rid of. That'd be my biggest thing is that as long as you're okay without the 20 grand.
Or difficulty getting a renter.
Or a renter too. All those things. Because, $20,000 and you can't find a renter, well, that's an illiquid asset earning zero rent that's costing your property
right.
tax every year. So just, it's a tricky thing to answer off the cuff.
That's a good answer, though.
Thanks
very
Steve.
Much.
All right. Thanks for the call, Steve. And you can ask Chad Gordon a question, too, by calling 303-442-4242. He is the author most recently of Wealth by Virtue, an award-winning book which divides all of your financial life into six categories. Very easy to understand concepts and very important advice about foundational notions regarding interest and time value of money and understanding your own time horizon and risk tolerance. So once again, that's Chad Gordon here for the rest of the hour. His new book is called Wealth by Virtue. You can actually meet Chad and hear him read excerpts from his book and take questions at the Tattered Covers Aspen Grove store. And that is a week from Sunday, April 29th at 3 p.m. So let's go back now. I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about market psychology a little bit. I think that's relevant right now. And you have some really great graphs, which would indicate that maybe people looking at the market in this past fall, September, October, November, were just thinking this was a gravy train going mm-hmm. one direction. And to take your philosophy, and which is buttressed by quite a lot of historical trends and how the market has actually performed over time, that would be the time to absolutely, instead of feeling great and buoyed by the market, that would be the time to actually be completely terrified and
sure.
step away from the vehicle.
Right. Well, so I'll circle back around to something you said earlier. You quoted Alan Greenspan about irrational exuberance. So and I'll be very specific with today and what's going on now. So right now, people always ask me, do I think the market's overvalued or undervalued? And you can objectively say that. So right now, you can objectively say it's a little bit overvalued. And if you're to look at a historical context, it's 1996 would be a similar time. And also it's 2007. So for those who don't know market history, what happened was in 96 was the actual year that Greenspan said the irrational exuberance thing. What he was cautioning the world was that the market has run up a whole bunch and he was worried that it was going to have a correction. People should be cautious. What happened was the market kept going up for 3.5 years and then the dot-com started crashing in March of 2000. So the thing you have to be cautious with was saying, so what can happen at this point is one of two possibilities. Is one, we could finally get the well overdue bear market. It's been 9 years since the last bear market, but on average they happen every 4.5 years. So we're way overdue for it. And this last correction was 10%. So that didn't, we don't get credit for that, unfortunately. So that's one possibility. But then the other possibility.
Have we had a correction?
Yeah, we did. So in February 1st,
okay.
To
We're
its
in
worst.
A correction right now.
Yeah, well, so these are all kind of artificial.
Okay. But it's
markers.
10% from
but,
the
yeah,
peak,
by,
right?
So, yeah, that 10% is usually a correction. We'll call it a correction.
Okay.
But we've come back from it, so we're like 5% off the peak. And again, I apologize for throwing all these numbers out. But basically, it's not a bear market. A bear market would be 20% or more loss would be the traditional definition of it, which happens, like I said, for every 4.5 years or so. So the thing you have to be cautious of is it'd be very easy to say, well, it's come up a lot. We're overdue for a bear market. Therefore, don't invest, which is a completely rational thing. But if it's 1996 and you ignored that advice and you just bought and held and didn't do anything, you would make more money than if you just waited for the correction, which you would have been waiting another 3.5 years. And conversely, the year 2007 was a similar overvalued level as it is now, and it went down 57%. So you don't know. That's the thing. Is that's the whole point of this is of my book is that you don't have to know. And it's really not if you plan right, bear market corrections are not relevant to shouldn't be relevant to your life. Style is if you can define things by when you're going to buy stuff with your money, you can basically plan for bear markets. You can know they happen statistically every 4.5 years and they last on average 2 years before they dig out of it. And so if you're not spending money for 20 years, there's no historical precedent for that being a problem by just wading through the thing.
One of the alarming things that I read in your book had to do with your analysis of the student debt crisis and,
right.
and how that came to be. Because, again, you know, I have a longer, by a couple of decades, historical memory than you do of just like, you know, the news and current history. And the student debt crisis, like, I can't pinpoint in the last number of years what happened to all of a sudden, like, was there a national or an economic or some, you know, convergence of events that triggered this? And yet
right.
now we have student debt that exceeds credit card debt. It's not extinguishable in bankruptcy. I mean, that's the law.
Right.
And you, in your book, Wealth by Virtue, came up with a very handy explanation about this. So it's cynical, but I'd like to share it with our listeners.
It is cynical. Thank you, Liz. So I used to work for the big banks, and so my cynicism is not uneducated. So as Liz mentioned briefly, if someone has credit card debt, so you hear kids who have $120,000 and they're 22 years old and, you know, getting out of college, which is mind-boggling and terrible to think about. But it's different than having lots of credit card debt or even during the financial crisis when young people would be given mortgages that they couldn't afford and they'd be stuck with the house. In those situations, they're painlessly enough reversible. You can declare bankruptcy. You can push the reset button. And yes, it's
walk away from the house.
You can walk away from it.
Foreclose. I mean, nobody wants to, but you can.
Right. So let's say you go into some esthetician school or some like trade school or some... you know, some school that costs $30,000-$50,000, and these exist, and they get into student loan debt, and you have a job that's not marketable, or which is possible. And I'm not trying to pick on any industry per se, but to me, I can't help but think of why is this happening? What's the underwriting going on behind it? Why would you give someone a loan that they can't market? And the truth is that there's almost no risk for a lending institution to give you a student loan because you can't get rid of it. It does not go.
They know they're going to get.
They know
back.
There's almost no underwriting risk to do it, and it's pure. And I'm not saying it's all that way. Some of it's good-hearted. On the face of it, it's a very PR-able thing to do as a bank. Is we're giving all, you know, we're enabling education, enabling the future of all these generations. But the truth is, when you're 18, you don't know much, and you don't have life experience. I don't say it condescendingly. But it's just the reality is it's not an age where you're usually equipped to make a very large decision like that.
In addition, pursuing education when you're 18 feels like what you're supposed to be doing.
Sure, exactly.
Exactly right then.
Right. And I don't necessarily have some magic solution. I just think the adults in the room need to give the youth some guidance on this and to say, don't do that or something to that effect to mitigate it. it's I think it's a failure of society and a failure of our peers to.
And what kind of stats do you have about student debt and the economic ripple, if any, yet that we can perceive it having in our society? Because certainly there will be less income, less wealth circulating in the economy because people are, you know, new workers, workers throughout their 20s and 30s who might have been taking that monthly payment and saving up for to buy a house will not be able to do that. So hard choices as well for individuals.
Right. Yeah. So the way that I see the chicken coming home to roost on this issue, the way, it's hard to quantify as a society how does this hurt us. In other words, how do you... You could say, well, okay, yes, young people aren't spending money and you could maybe pinpoint certain industries. But as a household over the long term, I think it's catastrophic because our initial thing that we talked about were the two twins, Terry and Mary. Well, if you're paying $1,500 a month in student loan debt, you cannot be Mary. And if you're making a starting salary, you cannot be Mary. You cannot afford to take that option, in which case you're dooming yourself to the life of Terry where you're going to be saving up money to catch up for 70 years of your life. And so the consequences are often more subtle and it's hard to say this is what it is. And I don't see there ever being a student loan crisis because it's such a subtle thing because you can't have default on the student loan debt. You go through bankruptcy. Well, on the other side of it, you just go back to paying it. And so the effects are just people maybe being more cautious about education, which is a negative thing, but it's,
And do you see that? Do you have clients coming in and, considering alternatives to a standard four-year education for reasons that are mostly based on debt avoidance?
Yes. And what I see is more clients who are putting their kids through college where maybe their parents put them through college and they're not making that promise to their kids quite reasonably enough and looking at other things. And there are alternatives. You can go to a community college for a couple of years. You can take, I think high schools have really done a great thing where they're offering more college credit at the high school level. And so if a kid's really focused, they can get a year done in high school, they can go to community college, and then you're paying 2 years of school and mitigate it quite a bit.
But don't you think that should be packaged a little bit more as not being a go-getter kid, not trying to be, you know, get a 4 or 5 in high school? It's literally just an economic decision. Do this in high school, and it will save our family or you, future borrower, X thousands of dollars.
Right. Well,
And you know, that might be crass for high schools to be doing, but certainly from the parents' point of view, that's just an economic decision if their kid can handle it.
Right. And absolutely. And people, and just to be clear, I mean, people should go to college and people from a career standpoint should get more education and certainly helpful in that sense. But in my view, the old note, and I know we're near CU, so hopefully they're not listening right now, but I feel like the old thing of going off to a dorm and living in there and going to school, I think that's progressively becoming a dated thing. Model is
because of the cost it adds.
The cost. I mean, I think the inflation rate of education is 6% or so.
I want to ask you to ask you about the tax bill, which is really unlike perhaps past tax bills, is something that will affect almost every taxpayer in the country, and in pretty basic ways, not innocuous, you know, passive investment vehicles or things that maybe not every tax filer might have to face. So let's talk about the tax bill and what you think and what you advise your clients to be aware of right now. We just filed April 15th,
right.
So that's all behind us, and everyone, you know, is not feeling too flush, I'm sure, right now. But how would you advise people to be thinking about it for next year?
Sure. Well, there isn't. So as far as like practical investment decisions and things you can change around to take advantage of it, there aren't obvious things in the sense that it's not like there are new deductions that weren't there before so much. I think the biggest thing that will change individuals' households is the standard deduction.
Which is doubled, right?
Right, which is doubled. So and thankfully it's on everyone's mind. So maybe you remember you're either itemizing or you're taking the standard deduction. So in 2017, the standard deduction was $12,700. So what that means is if you total up all the things you can write off on your taxes, so your mortgage interest, donations you make, car registration, those are the sorts of things that add up. So if
state taxes,
right? I mean, there's a list of about 20 things that will add up to what you can itemize on your taxes. If that number is less than $12,700, then you just take the standard deduction, which makes your taxes a little more simple. And so for like my wife and I, relatively early in life, we are not that far from taking the standard deduction. We itemize, but we're not that far off from it. Next year, we'll probably take the standard deduction, which is now about $25,000 or so. And where that really helps people is if you don't have things to deduct. So this is where it takes a little bit of mental gymnastics. And I do go into this in my book. And as luck would have it, this tax bill came out about a week after I published it. So you'll have to update the numbers in your mind, but the principle is still the same. I think around page 359 or so, I make the point that if you're not itemizing on your taxes and taking the standard deduction, you're getting free money and taxes back. And so if you think about it, when you get a mortgage, that's money out of your pocket and you're just getting some of it back. But if you itemize, you're basically getting a deduction for money you didn't spend out of your pocket. So you're kind of getting free money in a way. So that's where it'll really help. It'll help people in a subtle way.
So doubling the standard deduction, does that mean then that the first $24,000 that you earn is tax-free?
No, it's a little different. So basically, if you think of it's reducing how much income you have. So let's say you made $75,000. I'm rounding the numbers for easy math here. Let's say you made $75,000. The standard deduction makes it as if you made $50,000. And then how much you get taxed, it gets thrown at the tax brackets. And so the first certain amount, which those have all been adjusted down a little bit, but the first certain amount is taxed at 10%. The next chunk is taxed at 15% on down the line. And that is a new thing. Is you sometimes you hear of the top federal tax bracket. So that's if you make tons of money, then before you were taxed at 39.5%, now you're taxed at 35%. But that's only on the highest chunk of your income.
And these are going to go away also for individuals. Don't these changes phase out after a few years?
Which one, the tax brackets?
Yes. No, the doubling of the standard deduction.
Well, I don't know if there's an expiration on it. So usually with tax laws, the bill itself has a certain time frame, and frequently they're changed. I don't fathom it'll stay that way.
We heard a lot about the tax bill creating situations where, and some employers did give bonuses, tax bonuses, because the corporations themselves, they got a 50%. Many of them got a 50%
sure.
tax break. Do you think overall that we can expect that the $1,000+ or extra $1,000 circulating in the economy at the levels that, the average tax filers level, that will boost the economy? Do you think it's particularly stimulative?
Not really. It's one of these questions that has a million moving parts, but just logically it doesn't make sense. That just because, to me, if the objective is to incentivize jobs, I think they could have been more specific with it. So you could create a tax write-off for, say, if you hired this person, blah, blah, blah. You could create whatever, if that was really the objective to do that. But the reality is unemployment is 4%, which basically is full employment. So we're at a place where talking about stimulating the economy from an employment standpoint is not really...
It is,
exactly. And... to me, it's strange. So right now, our society is basically based off of what would be called Keynesian economics, meaning the way that we see the government is something that helps move the economy along when people are emotional and scared and don't want to spend money. The government steps in and does things to spend it. So that's when we'll run deficits. The spender of last resorts would be a thing that Keynes said. And to me, it's very unusual to say to have a $1 trillion deficit on purpose at a time when the economy, the GDP has never been higher than it is right now. That's the weird thing. So to me, the long-term consequences is strange when you think about, well, what's going to happen when unemployment goes back to, say, 8% or something like that? Are we going to then run a $3 trillion deficit down the road? Is that the implicit plan here?
How is paying off the deficit going? What's the plan for paying off the $1 trillion
there
deficit?
Is no plan to pay off the debt. And in fairness, there is decent amount of academic work to say that paying off the deficit does not do anything, or that the deficit is not causing a long-term problem. But I would say it doesn't make sense to purposely add to it.
Won't it if interest rates go way up?
Wouldn't
that be?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you can see a lot of ways where it caused problems. To me, my view is that the purpose, like, a deficit should be used for bad times.
When you have no choice. You need the government to spend money because nobody else can spend, and that deficit is going to be the product of that necessary spending.
Right, yeah. So that would be a classic Keynesian view of it. So in my view, like 2009 would be a terrific example, is that it became the spender of last resort, where you do the infrastructure, the Build America bill, you know, and do all the infrastructure spending and do that kind of thing to get money flowing again. And what it does is psychologically, people start to feel like things are better if money is flowing.
They're not going down so fast.
Right, yeah, exactly. And so this was like FDR would be a good example of this fear. There's nothing to fear but fear itself, where he became, you know, did deficit spending. But then the bigger one would be wartime, is in my mind, let's say there's some catastrophic war that costs $10 trillion. And so is there an appetite in the world for $10 trillion of bond debt? I doubt it.
You mean purchasers to
sure,
hold
sure.
the debt,
right?
Yeah, I agree with you.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's to me the concern is not necessarily what it does on a normal time basis, but on a crisis basis.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to It's the Economy on KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. Chad Gordon is with us live in studio. He's the founder and CEO of Green Star Advisors, and he's also the author of a new book about money management, investing, and financial literacy. It's called Wealth by Virtue. It is available for sale at the Tattered Cover and Boulder Bookstore. And Chad will actually be at Tattered Cover's Aspen Grove store Sunday, April 29th at 3 p.m. Talking about his book and how to manage your money and financial life better. We do have a few more minutes, and you can call and ask a question at 303-442-4242. We've talked a lot this evening, or not a lot, but I mean, we talked about real estate, and one of the callers called in about that. You referred to the really high rate of growth that the Boulder, Denver metro area has experienced in terms of housing prices. Inventory is really low. Is this a good time for people to sit down and start crunching the renting versus owning numbers? How do people do that? Or is that never a good option?
No, that people should always be thinking of that. So if you're renting, your goal should absolutely be to own your housing as soon as possible. In my view, that should be the first priority for every new, you know, young adult, is they should be thinking, when's the soonest I can responsibly purchase a place? And I talk about that in my book, as far as the number crunching. More contextually, as far as buying into a market where things have been going up so much, it's a tough time. I mean, I think it's a hard time to be a first time home buyer in the Denver Boulder area.
And yet waiting, which is what, you know, people would tend to do, you
sure.
know, to be okay waiting a while. If we think back to the real estate bubble bursting back in 2007 and 2008, I was living here then, and I just think that things didn't go up as much. Things stayed pretty flat.
Right. Yeah. So Denver was unique in that sense. And it's different because we didn't really get caught up into the housing thing in Arizona and Florida and,
right.
and some of these places where you had lots of building. We just didn't. We had a big building boom in the late 90s, especially in South Denver metro area. And so because of that, that didn't affect us. But nationwide, real estate on average went down about 26%, which is insane. And leading up to the crisis, there was a lot of folly about how real estate's stable, and that was always the undergirding presupposition that caused the financial crisis, was the assumed non-volatility of real estate. And in fairness, that hadn't happened since World War II, roughly, you know, 60 years or so at the time. today...
There's always an anomaly.
It's always the black swan, isn't it? So right now, it's a prognostication and nobody knows. You could make the same argument 3 years ago or 5 years ago of saying, well, look how much real estate's gone up. It's probably not a good time to buy. It's a bubble. And the answer would have been you should have purchased. So my view is always the long view, is that you should make the decision based on your ability to responsibly, meaning that you're not going to default on the payment, responsibly purchase it now. And knowing that if the value of it goes down while you're owning it, that you have the ability to continue to own it long past it. So if you think you're going to move in 5 years, don't buy. Or even, you know, certainly less than that. And even 10 years, I'd be a little cautious of buying. And my view is that when you purchase real estate, certainly as a first-time home buyer, you should keep it and rent it out and build at least some amount of a real estate portfolio. But the decision should be more on what you can do now, just being fully mindful of that this won't go on probably, but it might. I mean, we have net migration, which is a large driver of it right now.
I have heard, again, these are some neat rules of thumb that people, and one of those used to be actually that one should try not to ever spend more than 25% of one's monthly or annual income on housing.
Yeah.
And we see, I was just reading an article about this a couple weeks ago, that in Denver Metro, a big percentage of people, more than 50%, are paying more than 50% of
their annual income
on rent. So
right. I mean, it's absolute madness out there. And
the other one, of course, is to buy your first house and try to keep it as long as you can. And you kind of made that same.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think you should. I think that's generally my rule of thumb with investing.
Instead of always trying to move up to the
right.
Next one.
Well, so what happens is when you sell a house, and the second to last page of my chapter on real estate, I illustrate this, is that roughly it's about 6 or 7% of the price to sell it. You have realtor costs, which are about 5.2-ish, give or take, plus. Just it costs money to move. It costs money to sell it. It costs money. Usually you're going to do stuff, repaint and do things to fix it up to get it sellable. And so if on average real estate appreciates 4% a year, each time you sell, you've set yourself back 2 years on an appreciating asset. And when you appreciate the time value of money, the moral of the story is don't sell it if you can. Mm-hmm. Of course, some people need to get the equity back out of it, but you know, I'd fight hard to keep it if you can.
Do that math. Another really interesting concept that I think you turn the conventional wisdom on its head is you think it's a really big mistake to be too conservative investing once you are retired.
Right.
And I'd like you to talk about that, because we hear a lot, again, you know, be in equities while during your working life. And then once you retire, you know, go to bonds and just sit happy with your fixed income bonds. So
sure.
You think that's a grave error?
Yeah, I do. Absolutely. And this is a highly counterintuitive thing. So I'll use the example of my own grandfather. He would have been 65 in the mid 80s, somewhere in there. And so when he retired, bonds were paying north of 8%. And that was the rule of thumb. In my opinion, is what you just said is a hangover from the 80s, that society never re-educates itself or updates its maxims. And so when he retired, by every definition, he should just go to bonds. He can get a safe withdrawal rate of that. But my definition is that whether you're retired or what age you are or whatever is not the relevant piece of information. The relevant piece of information is, when is your money going to buy stuff? For my grandfather, it happened to be he was extremely frugal and had carpet from the Kennedy administration, and he lived off Social Security. He had a decent amount in savings. He owned two houses free and clear, but he lived off Social Security just because he was a frugal Scottish guy. And so by my definition, money wasn't going to buy stuff in his lifetime. If you could have,
he was never going to buy anything. He didn't. That wasn't his objective.
He wasn't, and he wasn't. Yeah, he was just going to keep it and keep investing it. And his six kids, one of them being my dad, inherited the same frugality. And so my parents aren't going to spend the inheritance that they got. So you literally, from 1985, you're looking at a 60-year time frame. If, say, my parents don't spend their sixth of what my grandfather had kept. And so that maxim, even though he was retired, really wasn't that relevant to the financial or investment decision making. And so the first step should be, well, when is my money going to buy stuff? And it's not hard to figure it out. Basically, how much are you living off of your investments? If you're living off it very strictly, then yes, you know, it should be in some sort of fixed income, something or other that you can rely
count
on.
Right.
But if you have clients with six-figure pensions and so in coming in, and they have investments and they don't need their investments, they're investing for the next generation. In which case, whether they are 60 years old, 50 years old, or 80 years old, they should be
in a long-term investment.
In a long-term investment,
the stock market.
Because you're investing for their when their kids are going to spend the money, or perhaps even longer. And if it's longer, then all the more they should be at, you know, quote unquote, aggressive things. I explain this a little more in my book. It's tricky to just throw it quickly at it.
No, but it's it does. And I think that the whole I mean, of course, you're a fortunate person if your needs in,
sure.
in your retirement are handily met by your income and whatever your investable resources are can sit and run for the next generation. That's not always the case. And so in which case, as you say, you need to really think about it, like, when am I going to need this money?
Right. And it's difficult to answer that for yourself. I think someone doing a financial plan is absolutely essential, because it tells you, and really the point of the financial plan is to define that spending time frame for you, is when is your money going to buy stuff? And that's the only way you can know, is to plan it out and to look at it. And it's true, if someone's using their money today, then that tells you it sort of if you can define when it's spending stuff, it automatically tells you how to invest. That's the first conversation. The first conversation is not how are you going to invest it, it's when you're going to spend it.
Do you think technology is helping increase the general person's ability to maybe take the time that's necessary to really spend on this area of your life? I mean, again, this is really important, and so few of us bother to spend time on this, to really look at our statements, to really look at our spending.
Sure.
You know, so, and yet this matters a lot. It matters more than maybe the time we spend going to the gym.
Sure, that's a fair argument. Well, with technology, I think there's always a yin and a yang to everything. And so the obvious answer is yes, the information is available and things are more equitable and it's easier to compare things from one to another. On the downside of it, it's also more confusing. As you have more voices, you have people saying different things, you have hidden agendas that are harder to decipher out of it. And I think that the technology aspect of it, it can lead to traps just as much as it can help. Is that in the not so old days, even 15 years ago, if you wanted to learn about what happened in the market, you'd go to your paper. Nowadays, there are 1,000 blogs, not always written by people who know what they're talking about. Newspapers are less of a thing, you know, financial information. People don't want to pay for what their education. They want free things. They want a YouTube. And I think it's there's a quote I say on like the third paragraph of the book, is that it's one thing to look up on the internet how to unclog your sink. It's another thing to YouTube your family's financial planning. And I think there's a wisdom to looking at people who've learned this stuff.
That was Chad Gordon. He is the author of Wealth by Virtue. It's a brand new book. It's award-winning. It has received the Personal Finance Awards from Axiom Business Books, Ippy Awards, the New England Book Festival, Feathered Quill Books, and as a finalist for Cal Writing Awards and Indie Book of the Year. Chad Gordon will be at the Tattered Covers Aspen Grove store Sunday, April 29th at 3 p.m. Chad, your website and where people can find out more about you.
Sure. The book's website is wealthbyvirtue.com. It will load very slowly, but it's very aesthetically beautiful once
it
does.
A beautiful book.
And the book, again, Boulder Bookstore, I believe it's on the left side, right when you walk in, up on the left side. And thank you, Boulder Bookstore, for putting it in the recommended section. My website for my business is greenstaradvisors.com, or you can just Google me, Chad Gordon, Green Star, and you'll find it on there.
And thank you so much, Chad, for your time and your insight and a truly useful book for all of us. And thanks so much to McKendra for handling the phones for us. Coming up next is Highway 322. Before we go to that, though, look at the changing weather forecast here along the Front Range. Tonight, we're going to have cloudy skies, low temperature around 40 degrees. The winds are going to kick up after midnight. Friday, chance of rain, and then rain likely in the afternoon, possibly a thunderstorm. High temperatures will reach the mid-50s. Again, we are going to have gusty winds in the afternoon, and the chance of precipitation on Friday is 70%. Rain overnight and into Saturday. Rain and snow on Saturday, becoming all rain late morning. High temperature will reach about 50 degrees, and we have an 80% chance of precipitation on Saturday, and sunny skies moving back in for Sunday with high temperatures in the upper 60s. That does it for me, and it's the economy. Stay tuned for Greg Schultz and Highway 322.
Welcome to Highway 322. It's 7:02 right here at your community radio station, KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. Again, thanks for tuning in for 1 hour of Americana and folk music. We're going to kick it off with an old one. We'll talk about it on the other side. 303-442-42 if you would like to chat. If not, you can always send an email at dj@kgnu.org. Thanks for tuning in.
Can't get down there, I won't get down and stay. diamond ring held on my hand, I never will forsake. Some take him by his lily white hand, some take him by his feet. We'll throw him in this deep, deep well, more than 100 feet. Lie there, loving him, really, till the flesh drops from your bones. The girl you have in that merry Greenland still waits for your return. Fly down, you little bird, and alight on my right knee. Your cage will be all purest gold, in need of proper care. I can't fly down.